Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Are we recording now?
We are. How would you like us to call you?
Well, my pronouns are...
Yeah?
grumpy. I'm sorry.
Based on your beard, I was going to just go straight in for she, her. And that's also on the basis that Nina has a established track record for dating autogynephiles.
Okay. How about we just call me Andy?
All right.
Hello, TERFs and trannies, Jews and Gentiles, Zionists and anti-Zionists. I'm Nina Paley, your co-host of the Heterodorks podcast.
And I am Corinna Cohn. I am a exiting trans activist. I'm finishing my last go-around, my last season. I'm retiring at the end of the season, Nina.
From being a gender-related activist.
I am. I'm going to hang up my tampons, and that's it. This is it.
There's a little burnout happening.
There is.
Getting a little burned out on gender, which is excellent timing, because I actually long predicted that the gender craziness was going to end when something far worse happened that distracted everyone. And it would take everyone's minds off of it. And then if you brought up that people canceled people like you and me in the past for saying things like you cannot change sex and things like that, they would just say how incredibly tactless it is to bring that up when this horrible crisis has happened. So I think we're about to enter that crisis.
And you're talking about Philadelphia going to the World Series.
Maybe we'll verify that by speaking to our guest, guest, Andy the Anti-Zionist. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you. That's one descriptor, I suppose.
His first name is Andy, and his last name is the Anti-Zionist.
Is that Italian?
Sure, why not? Actually, one of my brothers did the genome, one of those genome projects, and it turns out we have like 40% Western European and Italian in us. Yeah, partly.
I could tell by the beard.
You're half Palestinian.
I am, or as I like to say, Semitic.
Half Semitic. Corinna is also half Semitic.
Well, 49%.
Well, you're half Semitic, 49% Jewish.
Jewish. I mean, I don't know Corinna's national origins of Corinna's ancestors. So whether it's Eastern European or.
Well, my father's parents migrated to the United States in the 1910s from, it was called Galicia at the time. And now it's Poland.
Yeah, so East European, yeah. I would argue that that's not really Semitic. I mean, it's Jewish, but it's not Semitic.
Yeah. Whereas Andy looks like an Ashkenazi Jew because he's half...
Now, don't dox.
He's half Arab and half European. Yeah.
And he does not have a beard.
He's actually a beautiful woman with a low voice.
So how did your family end up in the United States, and which side of your family is that?
My father is Palestinian, and my mother came from Germany. I'll go ahead and dox her that way. But they came here as students, essentially, and they met here as foreign students.
And they're both Catholic.
They both come from conservative Roman Catholic families. Well, actually, on my father's side, my grandmother was actually Greek Orthodox Catholic, and my grandfather was Roman Catholic.
So you're first generation American.
I am.
Yeah. And let it be known that many Palestinians are not Muslim. Some are Catholic.
Used to be around 15%, at least in Palestine proper, where 15% were Christian, at least going back decades. But there's been a vast exodus of Christians, unfortunately, in particular, just because they generally tend to have, I mean, generalized, they probably had a little bit more money or seemed to be in a little better economic position.
I'm going to guess, based on your apparent age, that your father was born before 1948.
Yes. My father is 90 years old. So he's born in 1933.
Whereabouts in that region was he born?
He was born in a small village, a few, couple of kilometers away from Nablus, in the West Bank.
Yep. So by today's map, it would be clearly what we would consider to be in the West Bank area.
Yes. In fact, it's been subsumed by Nablus. Nablus has grown so much. It's unfortunately, it used to be a beautiful little rural village, and now it is basically part of the city.
And your family had olive orchards, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the village was totally agrarian, basically. Olive trees, citrus trees, they grew wheat. Well, yeah, olives were the main staple crop. In fact, my dad in his memoirs that he wrote, he has a long, many pages are devoted to the olive press in the town. And all the work that went into olives and how much they were valued. I mean, it was the staple crop. You made soap with it. It was your profit crop. When you made the oil, that was what you would sell to make your money, basically. In addition to being a food and a medicine and all the other stuff.
And what happened? What happened to their land?
Their land has been basically become an urban area now, unfortunately. So I haven't been there since 1978, so I don't know what it looks like. My oldest brother and my father went back in 1997, the last time, and it was already pretty. It was sad to see there were suddenly six-story buildings next to them or near the old house. So I'm presuming a lot of those fields are gone. They've been sold anyway. I know a lot of my family's land has been sold, so it's probably developed.
Just because I'm naive about this, hopefully this isn't a dumb question to ask, but given that it's in the West Bank, is that land that was properly transferred to legally to other Palestinians in the West Bank, or is this land that was seized or occupied by the Israeli government?
No. This part would have been in what they call Area B of the Oslo Accords. Now, this was allegedly under Palestinian authority after the 1993 Oslo Accords. Yeah, so it's formally, it's ostensibly administered by the Palestinians, but in reality, it can go anytime, basically. I mean, there is no such thing as actual sovereignty there for Palestinians.
So 2 weeks ago, I really had no opinion at all about the Middle East. And I think like a lot of Americans, particularly one or two generation descendants of Jews, suddenly there are some very attention-grabbing types of headlines that are happening, not the least of which are the various events in the United States of Stars of David being scratched into people's front doors and Israeli flags being burned and Israeli students at universities being assaulted. And for me, even though my dad did not really drive in a lot of his upbringing of coming up as a Jew in the early part of the 1900s, suddenly I'm like, oh, this is making me feel like there's some uncanny similarities to what might have been going on 100 years ago in Germany. And I'd never thought about it before, but I've been pretty unsettled for the last 2 weeks.
Sure. Totally understandable. That is horrible stuff.
And at the same time, there has also been an increase in attacks and harassment of Arabs in the United States, particularly ones who are known to have been of Palestinian descent. So this is coming into a time of quite a lot of tension. So I can see why some people would be nervous and trepidatious about current events, but there's also been a lot of very strong public support for ostensibly the Palestinian people, but I suppose that's something that we're going to talk about in more detail. So as you see these types of rallies happening or people calling for free Palestine, like how does that affect you? What's your emotional reaction to that?
Well, I've been dealing with this basically since I was a kid. I mean, and so I have a long, I have a longer history of dealing with it. And also, without tooting my own horn, probably a richer, compared to the average person out there protesting, whether it's pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli, whatever, I likely know more about the history than most Americans do. Certainly most mainstream Americans, where they used to watch the broadcast television growing up, and even today, you're getting a very, very slanted perspective, and it has been that way for decades. So there's a lot of history there that is important, is really important. It doesn't excuse any current activity by either side, but it's certainly, you can't look at what's happened in the past 2 weeks and look at it in a vacuum and just say, this is horrible. These are horrible people. And it doesn't flow like that.
So what would you like to fill people in on? What do you think a lot of Americans are missing?
Okay. Well, for starters, I think I'm not even sure most Americans understand how many brutal ground invasions Israel has already made of Gaza in the last 20 years. In invasions that cost, on average, at least in the amount of lives that were lost in the Hamas attack, just as many, and really a hell of a lot more over the years, Palestinian grandmothers and children, which is what I kept on hearing in the news, was of course it's horrible, but is the life of an Israeli grandmother or child more important than a Palestinian grandmother and child? And there's been, if you want to play the body, it's not a game, but if you want to play the body count game and stack them up, you're going to see who's getting destroyed in that battle. And it's not the Israeli.
Well, I got to tell you, anybody who enjoys the game of stacking up bodies is going to be very excited for this next season of conflict.
That's so morbid. I can't even. I shouldn't be laughing, but it's going to be bad.
Yeah, that's our brand.
So, why are so many people unaware of this history of Israel's, what did you call it? Violent. How did you phrase it? Violent.
Well, like brutal, violent incursions into Gaza.
Incursions into Gaza. Okay.
Because you can look at mainstream American media. It's unfortunately, it is highly slanted towards the Israel side. I know people will protest against that, but whenever every single Israeli invasion of Gaza has always been referred to as, oh, this is a response to some action by the Gazans. Oh, that's always they never initiate anything, and that's just total. Am I allowed to use curse words or no?
Oh yeah,
sure.
It's total bullshit. It's total bullshit. And it goes way back to before the Oslo Accords. It goes way back to 1948 with the creation of Israel. It goes to be back before that. It goes to the many of the Irgun, the Israeli resistance fighters against the British in what was then British Mandatory Palestine. They actually introduced terrorist tactics into the region, actually, in all kinds of ways, including the King David bombing, which was done by Menachem Begin, was the former prime minister of Israel, was the head of Irgun at that point. And that was a bombing that killed 91 people, mostly civilians. It's always characterized as a response by Israel, never a provocation by them. And you can see immediately, I don't know if you've been following mainstream media at all, but I have to because I'm staying with my parents at the moment, taking care of them. They watch ABC News and so immediately the Hamas people are just referred to as terrorists. Israeli soldiers are never referred to as terrorists. They do, whether you like it or not, they do indiscriminate killing in Gaza and elsewhere, in Lebanon and much more so, and just as readily. But because they might not be doing it there by hand, maybe they're controlling a drone or they're from an American paid fighter bomber. There's surgical airstrikes. They are indiscriminately killing civilians.
Yeah.
And so why don't we call them terrorists, right? Why don't we call them, and then, of course, this is much broader, too. Why don't we call all the American actions, illegal American military actions in the last 50 years, why don't we call those people terrorists, too? Because we should. But it's always the little guy. I have to say, I mean, Hamas comparatively is a little guy. Palestinians are little guys. They don't get $3.8 billion a year from the United States for military every year, like Israel does.
Where does their support come from?
They don't get much. they, mm. they, they, By comparison to what Israel has, it's not even worth talking about. Sure, they get stuff funneled to them from various places, wherever they can get it from, but it's hard to get anything in there and out. So I mean, some people say Iran is supporting them, blah blah blah. Well, I suppose that's possible, yeah. But oftentimes, if you look at what's behind that, Israel's been trying to gin up a war with Iran, fought by proxy, fought by the Americans for going back 30 years now, so or more.
I don't know if it's fair to ask you this question, but you are probably the best educated person on this topic that can help me understand it.
That may not be, but...
And this is very specific to Gaza, but I know that Gaza borders two countries. Borders Israel and it borders Egypt.
Yep.
And it's very confusing to me that this is always that the dynamic is always presented as a dyad, Gaza and Israel, when one of those borders could be used for moving refugees and products in and out or supplies in and out.
Sure, except when Israel was bombing it, which they did just recently. It's like the entry. They bombed it right after the
Rafah, I think is the gate. And I actually looked into that, and they didn't bomb the gate itself entry, but they did bomb nearby.
And that makes anything precarious there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but the real reason there is, I'm no fan of virtually any of the Arab countries as far as their policies. The deal with Egypt is when they signed this peace deal in 1977, Jimmy Carter brokered this thing between Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, I think it was. That was all tied to American aid. So in other words, as long as they play nice, they get American aid. Egypt's also quite dependent on American aid for all kinds of things. So Egypt has to play nice. They basically have to do it. I mean, they don't talk like they do, but they have to play nice with Israel, and they have to pretty much do what Israel wants them to do on the border, things might go south for them. So that's my opinion, anyways. So the other issue is, like, I know a lot of people say, well, why doesn't Egypt just take those Gazans as refugees? Why can't they flee to Egypt temporarily? You know, because the reason they and a lot of the Arab countries don't want to take them is because they know what the precedent is. Palestinians leave their land, and then they never get to go back. In violation of Article 49 of the conventions. This happened multiple times. Happened in 1948, happened in 1967, and both wars where Israel won territory, kicked people out, and then they have the right to go back to their homes, and they were not allowed back in. So the Arab countries don't want to continue that allowing that to happen. So. And then also, they probably Egypt doesn't have Egypt's in bad shape. They can't. They don't want to deal with a million refugees coming in. What are they going to do? They don't have the money for it. And it probably and of course there's always political instabilities that have to be reckoned with too. You bring in a million, half a million angry people. They're not going to want to live under tyranny in Egypt either. So,
what do you think has motivated the? I don't know if it's probably not majority, but more popular than ever opposition to Israel, like among young people. Like I think there were polls recently and a majority of people under 30 or under 25 are opposed to Israel at the moment in the US or the West.
I can't really, I can't explain. I know some of that's sort of like the fad thing, kind of where this is the cause du jour. Some of that is super. I think somewhat superficial, but hopefully enough people. I mean, enough people have. Well, okay. I think part of the real reason is it's amazingly obvious to anyone who looks at the situation what's been going on for decades. I mean, it's not. It takes next to no analysis at all to understand what's happening. The dynamic is very simple. It is one people slowly grinding another people out of their land, out of their own homeland that they've lived in for generations, many generations. And even though Israel has put up an amazing, the best propaganda campaign the universe has ever seen, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the way they portray Israel and the way they demonize Palestinians constantly and dehumanize them. even with their excellent propaganda campaign, people can see, I think people can see through some of that, right? They can see that the news that's been on them for Palestinians for decades getting tighter and tighter and tighter and closing up. And they know there's, I know what I think, what my opinion on it is, I know what's coming. And I know, I've known what's coming for probably 30 years. I got a taste of it when I was a kid, when I went there when I was 12, and I saw how I was treated by the Israelis, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed American kid. And because my crime was that I was the son of an Arab man who was born and raised in near Nablus, and I was treated like a piece of feces, basically, by the Israeli soldiers because of that. Upon my very first day of entry there. So, and there are other things I can tell you anecdotally about what I experienced on my trip there. But so that, I got a very good feeling for what the Israeli system thinks of Palestinians. And it is horrifying. And you know that the only solution they have for what they consider their demographic problem is the elimination of Arabs. Totally, from all the lands there. And that's always been coming. And that's been that way since, honestly, probably if you look back at the start of Zionism, that's when the 1887 Basel Convention, Basel Congress, it was a Zionist Congress, when they were trying to decide where to put a homeland. And Palestine was one of the places, one of the candidates. And they knew the land had people on it. There's a famous quote. It might not be from Theodor Herzl himself, but there was apparently two Austrian rabbis who had gone to visit Palestine, cabled back to them, "The bride is beautiful, but she is married to another man." So this was back in like 1887. So they knew the land had people, but they decided this is where we're going to put our home. And since then, it's been pretty nonstop. No matter what happens, they're always grinding more and more and more. So since 1993, the alleged peace accords, the settler population in the West Bank has gone from 200,000 to like 750,000. Mm-hmm. The numbers are approximate. So there's no actual intent for peace. There's no actual intent to live together. This is simply putting, as Ariel Sharon said many times, former prime minister, he's putting facts on the ground.
Yeah.
So to me, that's what all I've ever seen is this grinding machine that is going to get rid of all the Arabs. Even though what we hear in America, and I'm sure you both heard maybe growing up, is that, the Arabs are trying to push the Jews into the sea. And that's the Orwellian nature of it, is that, yeah, sure. Yeah. And I'm sure there are some Arabs that said that. But in reality, what's really happening is this slow grind ethnic cleansing and has been going on for literally 75 years now.
Now, to be fair, there's at least tens of thousands of people who are out marching around the world right now who are stating their intent to drive Israelis out of that area. That they're establishing that free Palestine means to eliminate all of the Israelis from that part of the world, which is not normally said in such blunt terms. So it's basically a genocidal intent.
Sure, I can't. I don't support that. I can't speak for them. I don't know what they mean by that, but yeah, that's horrible too.
Yeah,
we clearly can't do that, right? What we can do, maybe, but which is why not have, if you want an actual democracy there and you want people to be free, why don't you have an actual democracy there? Have people be represented, no matter what their religion, what their ethnicity, mm-hmm. right? If they all live there.
So a secular state.
Sure. I mean, that's, if you want any sort of just solution, that's the only thing, right? I mean, wouldn't we agree that that's what we have to have? But otherwise, it means one of the proper religion members is going to be tossed out.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, who the heck knows? I mean, some of this could just be the usual, Bibi Netanyahu's in trouble again politically, so he's going to gin up something. So it could be something as simple as that.
Wait. What do you mean he's going to gin up something?
He's going to, he wants to, whenever there's a pretty long history of whenever Israeli prime ministers are in trouble, they gin up a war. They either invade Lebanon or they go attack, they get popular again, or they attack Gaza. This is pretty standard behavior.
I mean, is what's happening now not a war? Is it not a war yet? It's a war. He's not popular, sure. Is he? Like, I thought he was pretty unpopular right now.
No, Well, okay. So listen, I don't know. This is speculation, but the first thing, Corinne, I don't know if you know, Mina called me. We talked a couple of days after Miss Major, and she wanted to get my hot take on this. My first reaction when I heard the news, the first reaction I had was, there's zero chance that Israel did not know this attack was coming. Zero. I stand by that. I mean that there is zero chance. So that begs the question, well, why would they allow this to happen? So, and I know there are people who say, well, you know, there was just an intelligence failure, blah, blah, blah. And even though the Americans and the Egyptians both reported giving warnings. Yep.
Like 9/11. Where we did have intelligence that hijackers were planning something, and I think at least in the United States, people did not take it seriously and did not think that the scale of it could ever be so astonishing as it was. Yeah. They had a failure of imagination.
The fact that I believe there's pretty much zero chance that this was not known by the Israelis means it was intentional. I mean, I don't know how much else you can say. So they can't go from saying, "Oh, well, we had an intelligence failure," to suddenly 2 hours later, but using precision bombing only to attack Hamas targets in Gaza. You know, they were bombing within a matter of hours, right? So how do they at one time have this amazing intelligence where they know where exactly where all these Hamas targets are in this super crowded urban area, and without of course hurting any civilians or you know minimizing that, and yet they somehow missed this giant quote invasion or from that must have taken obviously months to train for and plan, and on one of the most surveilled borders in the world, right? It defies belief that they didn't know it was coming. It's just, I don't even think it's a failure of imagination. I think even that's giving them that defies belief. It's just no.
Yeah. In fact, I think one of the Hamas leaders said that they'd been planning it for 2 years.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, it obviously requires that, but so it begs the question: why would they allow this? And it might be that Netanyahu just needed a war. To make him to save his political position again, but at some point too, like I really believe based on the facts on the ground that they are going to wipe out the Arabs there someday, and maybe this is the start of it. They need a pretext, obviously. Part of it might be sort of stress testing, seeing how the Americans respond to what they do, and they may, you know, if you're following the news, I suppose you are there. They're trying to widen it. Hezbollah's getting involved allegedly. There's all kinds of cross-border stuff in Lebanon. They're making all kinds of noise about Iran doing this and that. And so they probably want a bigger conflagration at some point so they can finish the job.
And by they, you mean Israel is trying to expand the war. Israel's trying to cause Hezbollah to attack from Syria and Lebanon.
It's possible. It's certainly possible Hezbollah is acting independently too. But I think the overall strategic picture for Israel is the same as it's been since the formation of Israel, which is remove all Arabs. Whether it was in 1940, the 48 war, you can read Yitzhak Rabin's autobiography. There were two cities, Lida and Ramli. About 50,000 Palestinian inhabitants. He went to David Ben-Gurion, who was leading the Zionist military at that point, and to ask what are we? We clearly can't leave these towns here. They're in a very strategic position for us. And Ben-Gurion didn't say anything, but he gave a gesture. And Rabin describes it. The gesture was very clear. It was get rid of the Arabs. Mm. And so that's been like that's very steady along the entire way. They want to get rid of the Arabs.
All right. So
Nina makes gestures at me sometimes, and those are very clear too.
I know, and I misgender him all the time. But you know what? He refuses to be genocided. So that foils my plans.
He keeps doing this throat cut gesture at me, and then pointing.
He's like Gaza. At me, he's like the Gaza of my Holy Land. Anyway, Andy. So you're saying that when you say the Israelis, I get a little. I want to just say not all Israelis. There's a lot of people.
That's true.
Living in Israel,
the
leadership,
state of Israel.
Okay, so the leadership, and of course these leaders keep being elected or whatever, they keep finding themselves in positions of power. If what you're saying is true, then you have these people, this Jewish state that wants to eliminate Arabs and wants to eliminate Arabs in the region, right? Like it wants to get all the Arabs out of Gaza and the West Bank, and then maybe they'll stop there or maybe not.
Yeah, my main focus is on Palestinians. That's my tribe.
You know, right. So then you would say that, you know, given this threat, the Arabs in the region have a right to defend themselves.
Well, surely anyone does, right? Now you can look at, so it's enshrined in international law. An occupied populace does have the right to resist using force against the occupying military, for sure. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say it. Against civilians, no. Civilians are sacrosanct on either side. So yeah, they absolutely have the right to attack and kill Israeli soldiers. They do, who are engaged in activities that are harmful. They absolutely do.
Yeah, Israeli soldiers in their territory.
Yeah. Well, which brings up an interesting question. So what is Israel's territory? They have never formally declared their borders. So, and they keep that nebulous precisely for sort of legal chicanery this way. So you can't say we're doing legal resistance here. Hmm. They literally have never defined their borders.
I guess that works both ways then, is if they don't have legally defined borders, then I guess even Israelis in the United States, so you know, if the borders aren't clear.
Yeah. Well, how can a state like that become a democracy where they're suddenly not trying to eliminate Arabs? How can you have that kind of culture where they...
Well, these are your people, you know.
No, but I'm...
Yeah, come on, Nina.
I'm not Israeli and I'm not a Zionist, but I mean, you know that there's quite a few Jews that are not Zionists,
of course,
there's even quite a few Jews that are anti-Zionist. So,
and there are many non-Jews that are Zionists.
Right. So I'm just going to separate those things, but we're talking about Zionists, right?
Yeah. So, well, hang on. I have to ask you an important question, Andy.
Uh-oh.
What is a woman? No, I'm sorry. Oh my God, I screwed up. What is a Zionist? I'm sorry, it's just habit. What is a Zionist?
It is someone who adheres to the original philosophy back in the late 19th century of providing a homeland for Jews.
All right.
Wait, any homeland or a homeland there?
The original Zionist movement was just, we need a homeland for Jews.
Oh shit! Well, you know what? I might be a Zionist after all.
There were multiple candidates. In fact, I believe California was a site in California there, because there was a site in Africa and Palestine. Those are the three that I've heard of.
What about Florida?
I'm a Zionist. I would like there to be a Jewish homeland in East Germany.
There's no East Germany, Nina.
Okay, fine. Then Germany.
Get with the times. There, good Lord.
If there's Zionist congresses, you should go to one and suggest that.
I mean, well, of course, I don't want it enough to do any work, but I do keep going. Like, look, if there has to be a Jewish homeland, it should be in Germany. And there's
that's not going to be that difficult to pull off either, though, Nina, because my understanding is that most of the Israelis live in trailer parks, and they can just load up their homes and take them. So they're going to have to carry them over the mountains, but they'll get to Germany and they can just set up in East Germany.
Oh, I see. They'll travel through Asia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They got to be careful of those deserts, though. You know what happens.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I thought a Zionist was someone that wanted a Jewish state in, I guess, the Levant, or
in modern times. Sure.
Zionism to me is associated with that piece of land, which of late, maybe I thought this before, but of late I've been feeling more confident that there will never be peace in that region because it has always been between empires. It will always be the site of empires, huge clashes that go far beyond the land that's right there just because of how the land is situated.
I want to talk about these definitions first though, Nina.
Okay.
Because so we have a definition of a Zionist. I want to repeat it back and make sure I'm understanding it correctly. As somebody who believes that there should be a homeland for the Jews, and by homeland, what that really implies is some sort of ethnostate where Jews are the administrators of the government. Is that what it means?
I did a little reading of it. Interestingly, some of the original founders of Zionism didn't use the word state at all. They just said a homeland. So I think in its modern conception, yes, it means a Jewish state. Yes.
States are sort of a modern thing anyway, so it would make sense if there was a different terminology before the modern terminology came about.
I think many early Zionists were like utopian Marxists.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I believe.
And they really, you know, they weren't religious. They wanted like a fresh start, and that would be great for all of humanity. And they totally envisioned living in harmony with.
Which is a great idea,
brothers. Yeah. Utopia is always a great idea. It should stay in the realm of idea.
Until it meets human corruption, which to me, in fact, I almost liken a bit like, I'm not a communist. I don't particularly care for the communism. But the ideas aren't so bad, I think.
Sure.
But in practice, of course, it's always been obviously corrupted and it doesn't work. It simply doesn't work with actual human nature. And so to me, Zionism, it's not a bad idea in a vacuum. It's a great idea. Sure, there obviously is a lot of historical oppression of Jews, and it'd be nice to have a good, safe place for them.
Yep.
But then to ignore the reality of the people that are already there and just run over them is that's wrong too.
Yeah, I want to go back to these definitions for a minute though, because I want to bring up something that our friend Ibram X. Kendi said once, which is that it is not sufficient to not be a Zionist. One must be actively anti-Zionist. So, but before 2 weeks ago, I was.
Wait, it's not sufficient.
Oh, I'm sorry. He said racist. Oh, I'm confused again. What is a woman? What is a racist? We're just never gonna. I'm doing a terrible job tonight, Andy. That's my fault. I would not have called myself a Zionist before 2 weeks ago because my thought was, if you had asked me at the time, I don't. Just like Nina says, I think that what they decided to do inevitably is going to lead to strife eternally. I didn't think it was a good idea, but then also, I don't have strong opinions about most states, most countries, like the borders of most countries. Even during our lifetimes, we have seen borders redrawn all over the world.
Oh yeah.
And to see states defending their territories or trying to annex more territories is seems to be just how history works. Like a couple of years ago, we saw Russia annex Crimea, and now they're trying to annex the eastern part of Ukraine. So whether or not we get really passionate about it, to me, it's just like the world has these ebbs and tides of power. But then it seems like at this point, as Nina teased, she called you Andy the anti-Zionist, and you didn't seem to completely embrace that description. But if Zionism is support for there being a Jewish state, then what is anti-Zionism?
Yeah, okay. Anti-Zionist, if you call me anti-Zionist, you're sure. I oppose the policies of Israel in its current incarnation. Absolutely.
All right.
100%. I oppose the apartheid.
They're not exactly mirrors of each other. Zionism and anti-Zionism are not mirror images.
Like we said, the modern definition of Zionism is closer to that. We want a Jewish state in Palestine. So yeah, in historical, historical Judea and Samaria, basically. They're pretty close to being mirrors, I suppose. Yeah.
So if Israel had a different ideology, but it had the same continuity of statehood, but that it was more democratic and more liberal and allowed the residents of that region to join as citizens and had the same civil rights and franchise as any Jew there, then you would become a Zionist.
Well, sure, as long as you're not saying Zionism means it's Jewish, being Jewish exclusively, as long as you're not claiming it's so, yeah, sure, that's fine.
All right, there needs to be a name for that, like a unification. What is it? Utopian? You said no. Maybe that's not the right term.
So this state, would fulfill the requirements of being a safe. Would it still be a safe homeland for Jews, or just a safe land for Jews?
What's the difference? Just like the Homeland Security Act.
I mean, homeland is a weird. It's a weird word, yeah. Right? Because it's like, oh, let's put our homeland here. Let's migrate to a homeland. That's just, well, what is a homeland?
Well, they're claiming biblical right. They're claiming ancient historical, there clearly was some presence of Jews in Palestine, historical Palestine.
Sure, sure.
Going way back, So there's some of that. Now, I make fun of Nina with the, I'm a Semite. She's East European, so she's not actually Semitic. So, there is some argument made that, a lot of the East Europeans who are being, being brought in and made settlers, which they really aren't being paid to be settlers, they don't really have any historical claim to the land. They're Jewish, but they're not really derived ethnically from the people who had the actual claim. If there's a claim to be made for having some historical population live there, so you could claim that some Jews do have that claim, and I think some don't.
You're talking like a racial homeland.
Yeah. That brings up the thorny issue. So Israel frequently it changes how it wants Judaism to be perceived, or Jewishness to be perceived. It's either it's a race for them when it's convenient, and it's a religion for them when it's convenient. I'm not saying everybody. I'm saying the state, the powers that be there. They tend to be very. They use it to their advantage.
So. Yeah, everyone is doing that right now.
That makes perfect sense, because I remember in Germany in the 1940s, all of these people were saying, "Oh no, I'm religiously Jewish, but I'm giving that up right now. Let me stay here. No, I'm not racially Jewish. I am religiously religiously Jewish. Now I'm what am I? Now I'm a Lutheran.
Do you have any sources for that? I'd love that. I never knew that. That was actually happening. Wow.
It probably did in small numbers, but I'm saying this is in an alternate world. This is how the Holocaust was averted, is just by mass conversion, conversion therapy to Lutheranism.
I've considered converting to Judaism just so I can go to the West Bank and buy land.
I'm considering converting to Judaism too. We should join the same synagogue, but I don't know which denomination you
prefer. Here I am, Jewish, and I'm not taking advantage of it. I'm squandering.
Join us, Nina.
My Jewish privilege.
We're going to create a podcast together. It'll be called The Three New Jews.
I'm not a new Jew.
But you'll
I
be
was assigned Jew at birth.
You'll be spiritually refreshed. It will be like you'll be born again Jew.
You were Ajab.
I'm Ajab, yes. Ajab. Assigned you at birth.
You're not Arab, you're an Ajab. Oh, my. Yeah. Well, what else would you like to hear?
So people are splitting right now, very much culturally. What do you think people who are, let's say, getting more Zionist through this split, or more sympathetic to Israel? To be honest, as you know me, Andy, so you know I have not been very sympathetic to Israel for most of my life. I am more sympathetic to Israel right now than I have ever been before in my life. It's not out of ignorance. I've just never believed there was as much anti-Semitism in the world as there turns out to be. And I've had the privilege of being an American and not having to deal with anti-Semitism and seeing it as a distant sort of thing. And also the threat of it mostly has been, I felt Jews trying to keep other Jews close, trying to scare other Jews into the tribe or into like more tribal bondedness, which I have resisted. But I think like for the first time in my life, a couple days ago, when on the same day I read about the female rabbi in Detroit getting stabbed and the lawyer in Illinois, the lawyer in Springfield, I don't know if you read this rant that a lawyer went off on, this grotesquely anti-Semitic rant. And yeah, I had a moment where it was like, I was close to panicking about this, and that has never happened in my entire life. And now I feel a little different. And I, yeah. And it's not, again, it's not because of ignorance.
Well, it's ugly and terrifying. I mean, to be honest, part of why I didn't want to use my last name was not just for the reason I gave you earlier, but I have family. I have elderly parents. You know, people dox me. They look at my parents. And so I have some of that fear now too. It's not, obviously it's not coming from the anti-Zionist side, but I understand that that's a real visceral fear. The unfortunate thing, of course, is this is part of the propaganda machine of Israel has always been to tie anti-Semitism with opposition to Israel, which is gross and many and gross injustices over decades. And of course, it's real. Anti-Semitism is obviously real. I don't deny that it is, but these injustices are also gross and real, and they've been real and gross for 75 years at least to the Arab population there. And unfortunately, anti-Semitism doesn't justify doing what they're doing to the Palestinians, or has it ever justified that? It doesn't. And there's no reason Palestinians need to pay for the rest of the world's anti-Semitism. I understand. Listen, guys, I understand. It's scary.
Well, I'd like to put it to you and get your response on this, that there is a portion of the popular support for the Palestinians right now. But first of all, let's agree that it's fashionable for the kids. They're going to free Palestine, and then right afterwards, they're going to charge right over and free Tibet. It's just going to be a 1-2 punch of freeing people. And then they're going to forget about Cuba. But so forgetting the fashionable part, there is certainly a contingent that is concerned about human rights abuses, which have been well documented independently on the basis of how Israel has treated Palestinians and in Gaza, and are genuinely, sincerely concerned about the living conditions and the humanity of the Gazans. But I will put it to you that what is going on right now is that there are also people jumping on the bandwagon because they don't particularly care about the Palestinians. It's all abstract to them, but they're very excited to see that Israel is under pressure and that a big driver of their interest in seeing Israel on the hot seat is because they just don't like Jews.
Sure. I don't deny that. I'm sure that's very real. Yeah, absolutely.
So when you say that Israelis used propaganda to conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, I don't doubt that there's been a lot of propaganda from Israel. So I'm going to grant you that. But I would say that what I'm feeling, and Nina, I suspect we're in the same boat here, but you'll tell me if we're not, that the hatred of Israel from people who are chanting things like kill the Jews or who are scrawling things on walls like kill Jews, or who are desecrating synagogues in the United States, that all of those types of indicators that there's a real visceral hatred of Jews makes us start to think, maybe Israel deserves to be criticized, but maybe that's not all there is to this current trend.
That anti-Semitism in this country and other places is real, and sure, we should be concerned about it. Absolutely. But what does that have to do with Palestinians wanting to live free?
It doesn't. I think it has more to do with the movement that is supporting the Palestinians is striated, and it's not all genuine or sincere.
Yeah. No, I'm sure there are all kinds of opportunities. But unfortunately, the sincere objections to Israel are real and believable and documented, and they need to be rectified. They should have rectified a long time ago. So I listen, it sucks. It sucks that you guys have this horrible feeling. It is a horrible feeling. If you want, I can recommend a woman I work with named Anna Balser, who is a Jewish American woman who wrote a book called Witness in Palestine. Hmm. She's documented anything. You can go the whole death to Jews and the things you find scrawled on walls and stuff. You can go to the West Bank, go to Hebron, go to a settlement, and you will see the same thing written about Arabs, death to Arabs. I mean, it's the same. It's bad actors on both sides doing this stuff.
I'm worried. See, it's like death to Arabs on walls in Gaza and death to Jews on walls in Gaza. There, that's one thing. But to see a vandalized flag on my walk through Urbana, yesterday. That's different. I'm very selfish. I mean, I'm not totally selfish, but beyond my concern about world events, it's like this can have repercussions here. And people are not at the moment. I mean, everybody gets their turn, right? Like we're all descended from what might be called oppressors or victors, right? We're descended from victors. Sooner or later, every group gets their turn to be targeted for a little while. And I've had a nice life so far where the Jewish turn was over, but it's like, oh, okay, it's getting socially acceptable to do this right now. Makes me nervous. But it's, here. I guess it's Kohler Street, Kohler Avenue in Urbana, where when I moved away from there, some people had spray painted swastikas on that street, including on the home of a Jewish neighbor a couple of years ago. Well, Israeli neighbor had their Israeli flag out and people spray painted it.
Well, sure. That's nasty vandalism. No.
It's visceral now.
Yeah, it's weird. It's visceral.
It's happening on both sides though, too. You there's a kid in Illinois, right? 6-year-old.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Stabbed to death. And his mother also said many times she survived, but so it's not even that's not one sided here. I mean, maybe you're seeing it more because you're more aware.
Well, that attack on that poor boy was really horrific. My understanding is that immediately the local Jewish community joined them. Like these rabbis spoke out against it, and there was just immediate support for that family and immediate denunciation. Unequivocal denunciation of that horrific murder, which is a great response, right? I mean, it's a horrible tragedy, but that is the appropriate response to something like that. I don't know if it's going the other way, I don't know if I should probably...
I do a little bit, Nina. This woman who was the president of a Jewish synagogue in Detroit, whose name is right at the tip of my tongue.
Voller?
Something.
Yeah.
Walls? Stephanie Walls, I think her name was.
Okay.
And she had a funeral yesterday, I believe. And Muslims, Hindus, Jews, everybody came out to the funeral and were making similar statements of solidarity. So members of the Muslim community, members of the Jewish community, whenever these types of horrible events are happening, are standing up to try to appeal to everybody's sense of justice and humanity.
That is somewhat reassuring.
And for people who are the heirs of the Western traditions, broadly speaking, or the Abrahamic traditions, broadly speaking, have a lot of same foundations and same notions of justice and goodness. So hopefully that will appeal to people regardless of the loyalties that they feel to their tribes.
Or perhaps they have a sense of tribe of just being, you know, good liberal people, which transcends religion.
Can we, all right, never mind. I was going to say good liberals. I don't know. But there are.
I mean, leftists. in the good sense of good liberals, like people who are
adherent.
who are against stabbing little boys and
adherent
rabbis.
And you don't have to be liberal to not stab children, Nina. you don't see Matt Walsh out there with a lawnmower blade just swinging along a playground. Come on now.
Well, he does worse. He goes out and asks people, "What is a woman?"
Yeah, that's worse.
That's the real crime.
That's the genocide we should be paying attention to.
I know. Speaking of which, Andy, Queers yes. for Palestine. How do you feel about having the mighty queers fighting for Palestine with their signs?
Anyone that is arguing based on the merits of the gross injustice that they've faced for 75 years is fine. It's totally fine. That's fine.
Oh, queers people have been around for all of history, not just the last 75 years.
Well, yes, but the Queers for Palestine that Nina's referring to. Anyone that recognizes the injustice and speaks up about it is fine. That's great.
You don't think that maybe when people see those signs, they question the seriousness and the awareness of the people that are out there?
Sure. They might. Sure. Listen, protesters in general, I believe the masses go out and say, "What a bunch of idiots up there." You know, what are they? And they ignore them mostly. I mean, heck, I you know, after the first, after the Iraq invasion in 2002 or 2003, I was out protesting a lot. And you know, most people just go by you and don't give a crap. I don't think though that's not going to swing anybody's opinion one way or another, that there's queers for Palestine in some way.
It's easy to make fun of them though, for the obvious reason, which is that there's no signs that say like Hamas for gays, right?
it's not gays for Palestine. It's queers for Palestine.
Listen, I can't speak for them. You'd have to address.
Yeah. Absolutely,
I have no strong opinion on that matter. I'll take any legitimate support that Palestinians can get is great.
I'm gonna just make a side observation here because it's intriguing to me because it's on the gender edge still, which is that so many of these statements that I would describe them as virtue signals because I personally have some doubts about how sincere some of these statements are, but a lot of these statements that have been made generally supporting Palestine or attributing the blame of the terror attack to Israel, however they've tended to be cast, because that's in Harvard, that's the slant that they took on it. Many of these statements disproportionately have been written by women who identify as non-binary. That's just interesting to me.
Is it a statistical outlier or just a coincidence?
Well, for one thing, it could be availability bias, right? I might be noticing it because I'm looking for it.
Yeah.
Another thing is that if it's a real phenomenon and it's not just one that I'm seeing because I'm looking for it, then it's maybe explainable because the generation that has so readily adopted all of these identity labels sees this as an excellent opportunity to find the meaning that the identity labels were not able to satisfy. And, you know, this is the next thing to fill the hole up with, maybe.
Yeah, it'll probably fade.
Yeah.
And Palestinians will be stuck where they always where they have been for 75 years in the shitter, basically.
You know what? 75 years on from now, though, Andy, they're going to be saying, our grandparents remember when a huge tide of the non-binary women of the early 21st century spoke up for us, and we still honor them with these flags.
Hey, if it were to work to produce a just solution, then yeah. I will be waving the flag myself. I might even go non-binary myself.
Do you think, Andy, that a just solution is going to be found, is going to be implemented?
No, I've told you what I think is going to happen. I'm pretty sure what's going to happen is what's always going to happen. And I guess, yeah, I wanted to, that opinion, I know it's very dark and morbid, but I really was informed by when I was 12 years old and I went there for 3 weeks with my father. It was being greeted at the airport by the Israeli authorities. You know, you go through customs coming in Tel Aviv, and I immediately whisked away from my father, taken into an interrogation room by an Israeli soldier. And I'm 12 years old, blonde-haired, blue-eyed American kid, and I had to strip down my underwear. Literally, I take off my clothes and cut my underwear. I was like, "Whoa, what's going on here?" And I separated from my father, completely in a different room. So that was my first taste of what they thought of me as a human being. I got a couple other, if I could just illustrate a couple other anecdotes, relate them to you, to give you why my opinion of what's happening is so dark. So in my father's little small agrarian village, it was mainly a Christian town. It was, the Palestinian towns and villages were generally mostly Christian or mostly Muslim. Even amongst towns, when you went to another town, you had to be on your guard. Like you were invading another town, and they watched you, and you had to watch yourself when you were there. But there was a Muslim cemetery in my dad's village, and this was 1978, and the Israelis had been occupying it since 67 at that point, since the 67 war. And they, the Israeli civil authorities, they called it, to modernize things, had put in a sewer system for the first time. You know, my grandparents had used outhouses and stuff like that. I will never forget walking by the Muslim cemetery the one day when I was 12 years old. I'll never forget the smell. And the Israelis had left the sewer system unfinished. It dumped raw sewage into a pool right next to the Muslim cemetery. And this was on purpose. This was intentional. My grandfather was the Mukhtar. He was basically the mayor of the village. My father and my grandfather went around with a petition to get people in the village to sign it to represent to the civil authorities and tell them, hey, you got to do something about putting raw sewage next to the Muslim cemetery. No one would sign it because they were scared out of their minds because, again, this is something not reported here. And throughout the 70s, especially, the Israelis had essentially an assassination campaign against any secular people and intellectuals who spoke out. In fact, a lot of Palestinian kids who came to the United States and Europe to study weren't allowed back in. They wanted to keep the educated people out. They wanted to keep anyone. Those are the dangers of Israel. They wanted anyone who was secular and intellectual gone. So people were scared. And so no one would sign a petition to have the Israelis take care of this pool of raw sewage next to the Muslim cemetery. I will tell you this too. We drove in a lot of Palestinian cabs to get to various places to see my relatives and to go to various historical sites. At that point, there weren't fixed Israeli checkpoints like there are now at all these places, but there were roving Israeli soldiers in jeeps, and they're called flying checkpoints. They could stop you anytime. They saw your Palestinian cab with your, of course, your ethnically identifying label on your license plate, which is, you know, pretty close to wearing a star on your clothing. A little less personal. It's in a car, they would stop us in our cab for whatever reason they wanted. And the first thing, I'm not exaggerating here, the first thing they would do every single time, and I might be, must have been stopped, I don't know, 20 or 30 times in Greece since I was there. The first thing they did was insult the Palestinian male drivers, the driver of the car. They would insult his mother. They would say something like, your mother's a whore, your mother's a donkey, your mother's a, in Arabic too. They would use Arabic to do this. This was in 1978. This was systematically, this was the entire military apparently did this. This was a standard operating procedure. So this is what the state of Israel thinks of the local Arab state. When I think of what's going to happen, if you judge by where things are now, it's at least 1,000 times worse than what it was in 1978. And particularly in the attitudes of I think the population now too, a lot of the population. So that's why I have no hope. I know exactly what the state of Israel thinks of Arabs. In fact, there was one of their parliament members who eventually was assassinated by a Palestinian at one point had said, in the Knesset, I believe, made a statement about these, we got to get rid of these insects. They referred to Palestinians as insects. This was a member of the Knesset, I believe. I could look up. But that's, so that is what, unfortunately, what the state of Israel thinks of Arabs, of Palestinians.
So culturally, Palestinians and Israelis will not be able to get along.
You know, sadly, they for a couple millennia they did. Essentially, there's always been a Jewish presence in Jerusalem. Certainly, the Western Quarter used to be. So they actually, according to a lot of people, they did get along quite well, reasonably well for a long, long time. It's not. I don't think it's impossible, but with the current, essentially what the modern state of Israel is a European colonial project, and so yeah, that generally doesn't work well with the native population. Like you can ask Native Americans here, right? So that I foresee the same future for Palestinians as I do for Native Americans.
So they'll be
they may survive, they may straggle around, they may be in a few places around there, but they're mostly going to get wiped out and pushed out and killed.
Yeah, I had a conversation with Corinna where I said that Gaza was like a reservation.
Oh, absolutely.
And then Corinna said, well, and Israel is also like a reservation because there were a lot of Jews living in what's now called, you know, the Muslim world or the Arab world, and they fled their countries and went to Israel. So you have like a reservation within a reservation.
It's like Inception. There's probably a little area of Gaza where all of the Christians are confined.
Oh yeah, there are many.
And probably in that little area where the Christians are confined, there's probably a little Palestinian Mormon baby.
Well, oddly enough, my parents, when they were very young, had my oldest sister. They actually went back. They lived in Ramallah, actually in the West Bank, where my mother lived for 2 years, my dad for a year before he had to come back to this country for immigration stuff, I think. But they actually taught, they both taught at the Quaker Friends School in Ramallah. There was a Quaker school.
Mm.
My dad taught math, my mother taught geometry out for the girls' school up at Quaker. So, yeah,
they didn't get the silent treatment. That's a Quaker joke.
It is? Oh, right.
Yeah, it is.
Right, the start of it. You know, I've always, I'm curious to try a Quaker service at one of these times.
We've been to one. Corinne and I went to one.
You guys did go to one. Yeah. Is it the together. First half hour? There's no talking. You just meditate and think?
That's an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I went probably half a dozen times to that because I thought it was good to have a space where you could sit and think about stuff because it was, what's the word? Regulated's not the right term. But you know, you have a time that you do it. There's a place that you do it and everybody's doing it together and just sitting and thinking about something and not fidgeting or trying to do chores or do something. Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty cool. Don't the Jews do something like that too?
Supposedly, the real ones.
The real ones.
Not the fake ones like us.
Yeah.
I
don't know. It seems like you two are both identifying more as Jews these days.
Well, I started identifying as a Jew when I made Seder masochism. That was when I started carrying a Jew card.
I started doing it when I realized it would generate an air of mystique.
That would up your oppression points. You're like, hey, people hate this aspect of me now. I better get into it.
Yeah.
Oh my.
You'll get your genocide.
I've scratched a Star of David into my front door. I mean, rather, I came out one day and I saw that somebody had... Gosh, I'm going to... Remind me to edit this part, Nina.
One way or another, Corinna, you'll get your genocide.
That's tough. Well, can I ask you guys both a question? So when Nina asked me, what do I think is going to happen? What do you guys think is going to happen?
I partly agree with some of your analysis, Andy. We haven't talked about Hamas at all. And I think that that's maybe a big gap, because one of the things that we probably should be talking about is who acts on behalf of whom, because we already know the Israeli government acts on behalf of all the Israelis, even though they don't necessarily agree with it. It's got to be a similar situation for Hamas. And I think that we would all agree here, and tell me if you don't, but I think we would all agree that if Hamas were to unilaterally surrender and give up all of their weapons, that the region would very, very quickly go back to at least a state of, if not peace, at least a state where there's not live fire happening. It would be a state where people would be able to not have shelling on their homes, and they'd be able to get food and water and supplies more easily. Not indefinitely, but it would immediately, that would be an immediate outcome. But I don't think that Hamas will ever surrender. I don't know. You look like you don't completely agree.
I mean, Hamas certainly has a militant wing to it. It's a social party, essentially. They provide all kinds of social supports for them with the money that they get.
At least they're meant to.
I am absolutely no fan of radical Islam or radical Islamicist, nor am I a radical Judaicist or radical Christians for that matter. There are plenty of examples counter where Palestinians don't have weapons, have nothing, and Israelis still abuse the hell out of them. No, I can't really. I don't buy it. No, it might stop the initial hostilities, but no, the machine's gonna machine. The campaign is gonna grind on, I think.
So, Andy, you don't think there's any chance that political pressure will dissuade more American politicians from supporting Israel?
No. I would refer you to Mearsheimer and Waltz, 2000, early 2000s, the Israel lobby. They did the first actual real intellectual academic study of the Israeli lobby in this country, and namely AIPAC, the American Israel AIPAC. Mm-hmm. I always forget the political action committee or political affair. Anyway. Mm-hmm. No, they have. In fact, there's been polls done of Congress. It's basically like the third recognized as one of the top three strongest lobbies in the country.
Recently, it feels like it might change. I've been contemplating that. Like, for me, no, you're shaking your head now.
Sorry, go on.
Like, if I thought that, this is funny, isn't it? If I thought that, I would be less sympathetic to Israel. But I actually think that it could change. I actually think that political support for Israel could decline enough in the U.S. so that the U.S. would, in the next decade, withdraw support or anything resembling current support. And I'm also contemplating that Israel could cease to be a state as we know it, which I'd never thought before. I've talked about how the stability of terrible institutions and terrible states has given me the luxury of fighting against them. But I, when they actually turn out not to be stable, when they go under, it's actually very upsetting to me. And it is upsetting to me to be more sympathetic to Israel, given that my whole life I have not been. The thought of Israel being no more is actually really troubling to me. I want to oppose it when it's strong. I want to oppose it when it's strong and unchangeable. But then it's like schools or, you know, the government or capitalism or any of these things, right, that I've been opposed to. It's like, wait, they're not supposed to actually crumble. That's not supposed to happen. They're supposed to be strong, and I'm supposed to like hate on them and push against them.
Well, your idea and theory that, obviously, if American support, that its reflexive support for Israel had since really the 67 war, if that were to wane, that would cause some trouble for Israel to maintain the status quo. Partly because the U.S. is a permanent member on the U.N. Security Council, and they have vetoed any and every resolution against Israel. I think one time they abstained from one. That was such an egregious act. So basically, they shield them in the UN from any actual. There's all kinds of UN General Assembly resolutions that have passed against Israel for all their acts, but they have no teeth. Only Security Council resolutions have it. So as long as the United States is backing them there, there's no pressure on Israel there. So I have yet to see any real pressure on politicians here, individual politicians. AIPAC tells them to jump, they say how high, because they don't. AIPAC is very well funded, and they dump millions onto the opponent of anyone who speaks out against Israel. I've seen interviews where they openly admit it. They say we can't oppose it. So it's a very powerful arm. And now that doesn't mean I think that Jews control Congress. I want to make that very clear. AIPAC has huge funding from Christian evangelists too, from Christian zealots. In fact, there's a whole branch of Christian evangelism called dispensationalism that believes that allowing Israel to do whatever it wants will bring about the second coming of Christ. So we're dealing with that kind of crap too.
I mean, it certainly does seem to be hastening the apocalypse. They're right in that respect.
It sounds like Israel's like the transgender of countries. Do anything you want all the time.
Hey, I buy that. In fact, I was gonna bring up the whole anti-Semite canard. Whenever you say anything about being labeled an anti-Semite,
well, hey, careful now, yeah. Careful.
Okay.
All right. What are you gonna say?
I was gonna say that the original transphobe was anti-Semite. Like the original smear. Oh. You're a bigoted. You're a transphobe for not reflexively submitting to the ideology I present to you.
I got to tell you though.
Uh-oh.
Now I understand where you're coming from, but in the last 2 weeks I have had so many people this is on social media, right? This is in person it actually matters, on social media it doesn't. I recognize that. I've had so many people who have messaged me with just the most hateful shit. Telling me to get out of America. Telling me that I'm a traitor, and I'm not even saying anything that's like go Israel or I stand with Israel or anything like that. I'm putting stuff out there that's very analytical and seeking to understand. But for no reason, people have been coming up in my mentions and just saying outrageous, like basically blood libel type of protocols of the Elders of Zion type of shit to me.
That's sickening. That's horrible. You know?
Yeah. So I can see why, you know, this is unusual because although I've had shit, plenty of shit because I'm trans, but this is the first time that I've really had, it doesn't matter what I think or what I've done. Cause transitioning, that's something that you choose to do. Mm-hmm. Reasonably, some people might feel like they didn't choose it, but really it's something that you have to choose to do. Mm-hmm. You're not born with a sex change, unless you're David Reimer. Sorry, David Reimer. But most people are not.
Can you be assigned sex change at birth?
Well, nowadays.
Yeah, assigned trans at birth.
Possible, but ATAB.
But sorry, go on.
I didn't choose my last name. I didn't choose my father.
Yep.
And for people to doubt that I'm a valid U.S. citizen for the first time in my life, to have people come and do that is really shocking to me.
Well, I mean, the simple explanation is those people are ignorant morons. I mean, they are. They're ignorant morons.
Well, that's fine as long as they don't vote and as long as they stay in the house drinking beer and watching VHS tapes.
I'm sorry, but they do vote. Welcome to God bless Merck.
They don't just vote. They put candidates that have certain ideologies into office.
They do.
And so it is not something that I can just brush off and say these people are idiots. Now I have to think, okay, what practically is the impact on this going to be to me?
Yeah. Aha. May I interject here? So now you understand exactly what a Palestinian, especially a kid born in Gaza, has been dealing with his entire life.
Ah.
You know that.
Also, I understand what the Jews in my family had to contend with when they moved to the United States, when they had to leave their own homes in Galicia because the climate was getting scarier and scarier. So I understand them also. So the people who've had to leave their homeland because of the prejudice of the local population. Yeah, now I'm starting to get a sense of what people have had to face.
The upshot is I'm not real fond of Homo sapiens in general.
That's great. Oh, thank God.
Nina's a hetero sapien. Well, you know that. You know that.
One thing about the current very hot,
she doesn't look like it,
pro-Palestinian movement. It's so hot. Is it overlaps tremendously with the same political groups that cancel me and Corinna. So it's very popular among people who I don't trust at all and who I think have terrible motives and who I think are extremely dangerous if they get power.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with that. I think they if they ever were to get legitimate, significant amount of power, that you're right, is dangerous. That's very dangerous. Yeah.
And I think that they're largely motivated by seeking power. Not consciously. They say that, you know, they're motivated by righteousness, but a lot of them are psychopaths.
I can't do anything about that.
I know that, but that's sort of what I was getting at with the Queers for Palestine thing. Is it's like, these are not the people that I want. Like, I wouldn't want to march with those people either.
Well, you don't have to march with them. You don't have to march at all. Marching doesn't accomplish much. I mean.
Yeah, I'm basically, at this point, I am just asking people what they think. And I am pleased to have Zionist friends, non-Zionist friends, anti-Zionist friends.
Well, you're poly-Zionist.
Poly-Zionist. Yeah.
Yeah, because you want there to be a Jewish state in East Germany also.
Yeah, a Jewish state in Germany. There needs to be a word for that.
There is. It's poly-Zionism.
I must admit, though, that I have not, I feel like I sort of know the Zionist line, so I'm not talking to my hardcore Zionist friends that much, but we will hopefully interview a hardcore Zionist soon. What I do think is that I find arguments very compelling. The positions are very compelling, and I am incapable of holding them both at the same time. So I'll find a really compelling essay that is by an anti-Zionist, and I will share it with Corinna, and Corinna will point out some things, and I'll go, whoops, that doesn't make any sense. And then I'll share a more Zionist or Zionist sympathetic essay with an anti-Zionist friend. And then they'll get into all these arguments, and it's like, yes, yes, all that is true. And I just can't have it at the same time.
Well, if you want to resolve that at some point in the future, if there's a moment, a time again when it would be relatively safe to visit Israel and go to the West Bank, I think if you want to just go and see what's happening.
No, I believe
you'll get a very clear picture, and it'll be very obvious what's really happening. Very obvious.
Andy, that's not the issue. I believe that. I totally believe that.
I think that might resolve this issue with you, where you can't hold both, where you realize, oh, there is one that is a little true. All truths are true, but some are more true than others. Maybe. How about that? We can have a nice Orwellian description of it.
I mean, I'll say this, that I visited Israel, and visiting Israel made me less sympathetic to Israel.
Yeah, you should go to the West Bank.
I don't think I can right now, but I already...
Well, I wouldn't go now. No,
I would not
you
go
know what?
Now.
Why don't we do a follow-up to this episode next year in Jerusalem?
Well, okay, you guys can be there. I will not be allowed it.
All right. Any final thoughts?
We're screwed. Yep.
Okay.
You see? Zionist, non-Zionist, and anti-Zionist agree and live in harmony. It's a utopia.
This has been great. I can't wait to edit it. And then, Andy, I'll have my people call your people, and we'll kill each other.
That's terrific.
That's great. That's going to take...
Start with me.
That's going to take such a load off of me, you two. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, folks. Thank you for listening to me. And I wish you the best with your podcast and all your future endeavors.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing with us.
Yeah. Likewise. Thanks for joining us. And TERFs and Trannies, thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.